You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everybody. This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this week we're looking back at everything that transpired in this division at the non-waiver trade deadline. And we'll also be looking ahead at the last 2 months of the 2015 schedule and what it has in store for these central clubs. We'll talk with Jeffrey Flanagan about the Royals' all-in moves and to Jason Beck about the Tigers being all out and trying to set themselves up for a better future. The Twins made a move to try to keep their playoff hopes alive, as Rhett Bollinger will discuss, and the White Sox stood pat with Jeff Samardzija. Scott Merkin will talk about that. I'll also have Jordan Bastian on to talk Tribe, so thanks for tuning in. Let's get to it. We're joined, as always, by Jeffrey Flanagan to talk about the Royals, who went all in at the trade deadline. Last time we spoke, Jeffrey, was between the Johnny Cueto trade and the Ben Zobrist trade, so another big move since the last time we spoke. And just with Zobrist in general, I mean, talk about a perfect fit with Alex Gordon out and then the need for, you know, some infield assistance in general moving forward. Once Gordon comes back, I mean, he's made an instant impact with the bat, hit a home run from both sides of the plate Saturday, another one on Sunday. Just your thoughts on that addition.
That's a guy that they've been targeting for a long, long time. They really admire his skill set. You know, he's probably one of the top two or three super utility guys in all of baseball. And you're right, they have a certain need right now in left field with Alex Gordon out. And then when Alex comes back, hopefully at the end of August, early September, they plan on kind of shifting him all over the place, a little bit at second, a little bit at third, a little bit in right field, you name it. And they'll probably have to spell Gordo a couple times in left, too, coming back from that injury. So just a great pickup there. Didn't really cost him that much, I didn't think. So the Cueto deal, of course, we talked about that last week, but that one did cost him a little bit more. But it just it kind of shocked all of us, I think, to a degree that – a team that was over 20 games, over 500, and knowing Dayton's record of his past record of not really going all in at the trade deadline, to see him pull off two moves like this was really pretty impressive. You often wonder, though, if moves like that will end up panning out, because certainly last year at this time they didn't. For the teams that went all in like that, some of them were just disasters, Oakland in mind. So you hope that Royals hope that they're not going to be in that category, but they felt like they added two guys that are good clubhouse mixes more than anything else. Zobrist is, you know, a good teammate. He's already contributed on the field, as you mentioned. Johnny Cueto is a good friend of Edison Volquez, and Yordano Ventura admires him. So I think Dayton thought that was a good mix for the clubhouse, too. So he was very careful. He went all in, but he was very careful not to poison the clubhouse in any respect. So pretty exciting times. They haven't played that well since they got the new additions, but I think it's just kind of an adjustment period, and they'll be fine down the road.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't deal from the big league club, which I guess is important. You mentioned Oakland last year, you know, trading Cespedes, and it changed the whole scope of that club, really. The Royals more just filled in gaps. Spoke with Eric Hosmer last week about Zobrist coming aboard. He said, you know, we struggled against good left-handed pitching, so he can certainly help in that regard. We look at his numbers against lefties, and but it sounds like Ned Yost is pretty adamant that Omar Infante is going to stay at second base when Gordon comes back, and Zobrist moves into helping out the infield more than anything. I mean, it sounds like he's pretty adamant about Infante sticking at second.
Yeah, because he values this is a team that's first and foremost is a great defensive team, and he's not going to upset that at all. I really think Omar could probably, I'm exaggerating a little bit here, but he could probably hit 150 and he'd keep his job, just because they value his defense so much. And that's how they win games still, with pitching and defense. They've got a little bit more offense this year, and Zobrist certainly is going to be a helpful addition there. It gives them another switch hitter to go with Morales, which, you know, they didn't have any last year. They didn't have any in many years, actually. So to have two in the lineup now gives Yost really a lot of versatility in his his batting order construction, and it really helps, I think, down the road. You know, like you mentioned, against the tough lefties who they've not done well against this year, but they'll find plenty. You know, Ned's told me several times that even when Alex comes back, Ben Zobrist is going to play. He's going to play somewhere, and they've got plenty of spots where he can play, because there have been times that Alex Rios has struggled against right-handers. They might maybe a tough left-hander Mike Moustakas, so you put him at third there, just to keep Omar fresh at second base. Maybe spell him once a week, so he'll still get five or six games a week. And just a guy, like I said, you know, a guy that Dayton Moore has just admired for a long, long time, and he finally got him, and I Dayton couldn't be happier.
And just because there's so much emphasis on every single outing when you get a rental starting pitcher like Johnny Cueto, what was the takeaway from his Royals debut on Friday night in Toronto?
Well, it would have been terrific if they had held on to win, but it was like one of the, I think it was maybe the first time this year they coughed up a lead after the seventh inning. I don't have the stat in front of me, but there haven't been many. So it was kind of shocking to see him lead with a 6-3 lead and they end up losing the game. So that kind of, you know, cast a pall on it all. But I thought he pitched pretty well against a really ferocious Toronto lineup that's just smoking hot right now. They're just crushing everything over the weekend. And he held them in check, got a quality start, three runs, made a couple mistakes, but I think they walked away with that thinking, hey, we got a guy that we know can take the ball every fifth day and give us a quality start. It gives them a lot more depth. You know, with him and Volquez and Duffy and Ventura, they feel really solid about their front four. So going into the playoffs, that's going to be huge.
And, of course, the other thing, the big thing to come out this weekend was the situation with the Blue Jays.
Oh, boy.
The benches clearing incident there, and just a lot of smack talk back and forth. Jose Bautista saying he lost a lot of respect for Ned Yost after Yost's comments about the Blue Jays offense, and then Yordano Ventura piping off about Bautista, and Edison Volquez calling Josh Donaldson a baby.
All right, Dickie.
We've had a lot of these situations with the Royals this year. I mean, the main thing I took away from this one was how great it would be to see these two clubs face each other in the playoffs. But what did you come out of this with? What were your thoughts coming out of this?
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Show? I mean, I really did think the same thing. This would be one really exciting matchup in October. And very well could happen. That team, the Royals, to a man, just walked away thinking, wow, those guys can hit. I mean, especially in that ballpark, they just crushed the ball. And that's kind of what led to the hostilities on Sunday is, you know, those guys all wear pads on their left elbows and guards because they lean over the plate so much and lunge into the ball so much. I think the Royals, after 3 days of watching them launch home runs, just kind of got tired of it, and they started pitching inside. And the Blue Jays didn't react to that very well. So that led to a lot of craziness on the field and a lot of craziness in the clubhouses afterward. You know, I posed a question to Eddie Volquez, you know, were you surprised? And that's what elicited the big baby comment. That thing, of course, just went viral. And then, you know, you have R.A. Dickey, you know, saying, hey, these guys are used to pushing people around and they don't like it when, you know, someone just as big as them shows up on the playground. And just some great quotes, really. And it'll certainly set up for possibly a great rivalry in October if it happens. But I don't know. I mean, it's just the Royals, it's hard for me to imagine that this is a team that made the playoffs for the first time in 29 years last year, and suddenly they're the bullies of baseball. It's hard for me to wrap my arms around that. I'm with them every day, and I just don't see that. You know, they do believe in themselves, and they're a tight-knit group, and they stand up for each other. But they really don't go out hunting for fights. They're not the Oakland A's of the 70s. I mean, they're not a fighting type of group. They're very competitive, and they want to win badly. But it's just the notion that they're doing this stuff on purpose. You know, some people have brought up the point too that the incidents that they've had this year, coincidence or not, have come against either ex-A's or current A's. You're talking about Samardzija and Lowry and now Josh Donaldson, all guys that were involved in the wild card game last year. So is that just a coincidence? Is there some bad blood brewing over from that game? I don't know. It's just kind of interesting to me that, you know, they're the biggest brawls this year have all come with those guys. So we'll see how it plays out down the road.
Joining me now is Rhett Bollinger to talk about a Twins team that's had a rough go in the second half, but did what they had to do, I thought, at the deadline, Rhett, as far as, you know, making a move that helps them here in the near term, maybe even helps them next year as well, addresses an area that probably needed addressing in the bullpen. But it wasn't like a crazy move. It wasn't an all-in move by any means. We'll talk about the trade for Kevin Jepson, of course. Obviously, a lot of relievers change hands every deadline. What do you think made Jepson the right man for the job for Minnesota?
Well, I think Jepson, the big thing, is a guy who throws hard and gets some strikeouts. The staff is definitely a bullpen that needed strikeouts. A guy with a lot of experience. You know, he pitched for the Angels for a long time before getting traded to the Rays in the offseason. He's got postseason experience. Really, they just kind of needed an arm. They're talking to other guys, you know, obviously Joaquin Benoit and San Diego, the, you know, guy they're looking after, a guy like Troy Hawkins in Colorado, which is another guy they're talking about. So I think it was just kind of different offers out on the table, different guys are looking at to help that bullpen. That was the number one priority, and I think that Jepson just happened to work out best to make that trade with the Rays. And his debut didn't go as well as expected, but obviously it's just one outing. And as you said, the nice thing, too, is that the fact that he's under contract for next year, I think, too, was a big reason for wanting to trade for him, knowing that it wasn't just going to be for the rest of this year, but also be for next year as well.
Yeah, that is a huge key for them. Obviously, we've talked about it before. Maybe this is all a little bit ahead of schedule here in 2015. Maybe the Twins have proven that, going 5-15 out of the break going into this week. The pitchers have had an ERA north of 5 in the 13 games leading up to this week. What are your thoughts on the way things have kind of sputtered here a little bit the last couple of weeks, Rhett?
Yeah, that's right. They've definitely struggled since the All-Star break. As you noted, the starting pitching has definitely kind of come back down to earth a little bit. And the big thing, too, is at least recently the offense has really struggled, too. They had a tough time scoring runs over the weekend. The Mariners really, you know, Taijuan Walker threw a one-hit, you know, complete game. And, you know, they really struggled to score some runs over the weekend. So I think it's kind of been a combination of kind of a lot of things going on, whether it's the offense struggling and the pitching struggling combined isn't a good combination right now. And we'll kind of see if they can get it going. As we talked about earlier, obviously Jepson should help the bullpen, but right now it kind of seems like their bigger issue, at least recently, has kind of been the pitching in general and the offense. So obviously they didn't make any moves to address that. These guys kind of got to get it going. Obviously a big series here in Toronto. It's going to be a big month for them, and you know, a big series also coming up later in the month in New York. So yeah, definitely it's going to kind of be this time of year where we're going to kind of see if they can prove themselves. Obviously, a lot of young guys, and even some of the guys that have been around for a little bit, guys like Brian Dozier, guys like Trevor Plouffe, have never been around, a playoff race before. So we'll kind of see how it goes. And so far, since the break, it really hasn't been going very well for the Twins.
Brett, how serious is the Tommy Malone elbow injury? And also, what can you tell us about Tyler Duffy, who starts in his place on Wednesday?
I don't think the Malone injury is very serious. I think more than anything, it was kind of precautionary. Felt a little something in his elbow. And they did the MRI, the one with the actual with the dyes in it. So the thing about that one is if you take that kind of MRI and put the dye in there, you can't throw for about 3 to 4 days generally afterwards. So no matter what, even after the MRI, even if it would have showed nothing, he would have, you know, had to be scratched from the start. And they just figured that instead of going with the bullpen day and everything else, even though the MRI just showed mostly just inflammation and a small strain, it was better off to kind of maybe just push him back and put him on the DL. He might be ready within the 2 weeks as it is in 15 days anyway. And bring up Tyler Duffy, so they don't have to worry about, you know, using Trevor May, who wouldn't really be ready to throw 100 pitches or anything yet because he's been mostly going only one-inning stints as a reliever. So, and Duffy's a guy that the big thing for him is he keeps the ball in the park. This year he's only given up one homer in 132 innings at AA and AAA. He's a 6'3" right-hander, kind of throws from a three-quarter arm slot, a sinker ball kind of guy, but also has a pretty good curveball. It kind of almost looks like a slurver, a slider, just because he's got that interesting kind of arm angle. So we'll see. It's going to be a tough challenge for him, his first start coming here in Toronto, where we know the Blue Jays lead the majors in runs scored and a certain homer. So it's going to be a tough first test for him, but he's definitely the guy's had a very good year at AA and AAA.
And what's the latest with the shortstop situation? Obviously, they optioned out Danny Santana and Jorge Polanco over the weekend. It sounds like some combination of Escobar and Nunez. Is that correct?
Yep, exactly. The two Eduardos will be kind of splitting that. I think that Escobar's probably going to get more of the bulk of playing time at shortstop, like last year when he was an everyday shortstop for the Twins. You know, he had a pretty nice season last year playing every day at short. He hit about .275 with, you know, about 30 doubles. So he had a good year last year when he played every day. So I think they might try to see if Escobar can maybe run with it for now. But if not, they can kind of mix in Nunez, who's having a very good year offensively for a middle infielder. But really, defensively, I don't know that Nunez has in the past had, you know, chances at shortstop, but not exactly the greatest defensive shortstop in the world, so it would be tough to kind of roll with him as the primary guy. So I think for now, let those two kind of you know, split some time at shortstop. Polanco got a little taste of the majors again for a couple days with Plouffe on the paternity leave. And Polanco, I think it proved that he probably could hit up here, especially for a middle infielder. But the thing with Polanco is I don't know defensively if he's ready to be a shortstop and really if he's going to be a shortstop moving forward. So, and Santana, we talked about before, and his struggles this year kind of continue. So it's interesting. They have, you know, kind of four guys that they could consider there, but really none of them really grabbed the reins and have showed that they could be the everyday shortstop this season at least.
In the wake of the Dave Dombrowski news in Detroit, with Al Avila taking over as general manager and Dave Dombrowski out, we're going to bring in Jason Beck to talk about this news. And Beck, last time we spoke, obviously this is a topic that's been in the air with Dave Dombrowski in the last year of his contract. We spoke a bit after the trade deadline about what the future might be there. If the Tigers are retooling, rebooting, what have you, is that something he would even want to be involved in? Well, now the stunner, just a few days after the deadline, the news that he is definitively out. First of all, just your overall reaction to this news.
Well, the timing was certainly curious coming off of the moves last week. I think a lot of people, myself included, figured that was going to be a sign that, that if he was selling, that he was probably going to be around to see it through. And as it turns out, shortly after the sell, Al was being offered the general manager job. So it sounds a lot like the fact that they were in a position where the choice was to sell was something that ended up weighing heavily into a change.
From the outside, we're piecing this together. The way it was worded in the release, Dombrowski being freed up by Mike Gillis to pursue other opportunities. And, I don't know. From the outside, I don't know if this was something that was mutual or if this was something that was not so mutual. There have been, in the immediate aftermath, there have been different headlines between resigned or some of you even said fired. I know it's just shortly after the news here, you just came out of the press conference about this, but did you have a sense of if this was a mutual decision?
That's kind of how I took it. It's hard to tell. The fact that Al said that he was offered the job on Saturday, as Dave was clearly still in charge, I think it certainly doesn't suggest a resignation. By the same token, there were so many rumors out there about Dave's potential next stop that it's kind of weird how it came about. It doesn't sound like something where he went to management and said, either extend me or I'm going to look elsewhere. It sounds like there was something a little bit more orchestrated from within, and that if it was mutual, that there was definitely some force being applied from the ownership level.
What is the what's been the immediate reaction, from Brad Ausmus? I don't know if you've had a chance to interact with the players much about this, but what is the mood and the reaction there?
Haven't had a chance to talk with the players much. Talked with Brad shortly afterwards. There's definitely some surprise there, and I think there's some uncertainty in regards to his situation. Al Vila said that he's their manager for the rest of the year and that he'll be evaluated like everybody else at the end of the season. That was probably going to be the case regardless whether it was Dave or Al in charge. So from that standpoint, it doesn't change a whole lot. The main change is who's doing the evaluating. Al was involved in the hiring of Brad. So you got to figure that that relationship will play into it a little bit. It's not completely like a guy coming in fresh from outside the organization and wanting to have his own guy in charge. He's got that going for him. But that said, there's got to be some people nervous right now because there's still a win now mentality here. And that's something that Al Avila emphasized many times over the course of his 20-minute press conference. And if that's the case, then the fact that they didn't win this year would suggest that if Dave was held responsible to some extent, then one would figure the manager would be as well.
You know, this news comes on the heels of the trade deadline, and the Tigers received almost universal praise for the way they handled the trade deadline, really. The assets they were able to bring back for David Price and Yoenis Cespedes, a lot of people in the industry thought they did very well, considering the circumstances of, you know, moving two guys who were rental pieces and obviously will not be tied to draft pick conversation you know, after being traded. So, you know, this is obviously not a reflection of the deadline itself. It's more, you know, just the way things have trended in that organization, a chance for a fresh voice. I'm not sure, but Avila is not exactly a fresh voice. He was very much tied to the moves that have been made leading up to this. Yeah, him and Dave worked very much in conjunction with each other, correct?
Well, yeah. And, you know, it was interesting to hear Al talk about this change in light of the moves that were made just a few days ago. On the one hand, he was saying that, you know, the GM gets the final decision on those moves, clearly putting the responsibility on Dave for the trades that they made. But he also noted that ownership signed off on those decisions. The David Price trade might have gone down Wednesday night or in the early hours of Thursday morning, except that they had to contact ownership to get approval on making those moves. I think a lot of this has to do with the moves that led them into this situation rather than selling itself. You know, the fact that they were plagued with bullpen problems. I think the fact that the player development system hasn't produced, you know, necessarily as many prospects as they needed to keep this team young over the years. I know Al emphasized his player development background quite a bit in talking about taking this job and talking about how the organization was emphasizing developing players, but also trying to win now. We mentioned the player development part first. And also just the fact that they've had this run, and that while they're still trying to win, I think there is a little bit of a transition going on here. And I think we'll see how big of a transition. We'll be able to judge it better once the season's over and we kind of see who goes with Dave with his potential next destination and who sticks around here.
Yeah, there's already a lot of speculation about Dombrowski in the industry as far as what his next step might be. And much like a managerial change, sometimes organizations want a fresh voice or a new direction or a new mindset or what have you, but obviously nothing that's happened this season in Detroit reflects poorly on Dombrowski's standing in baseball at large. It seems like he's going to be an attractive free agent piece, pretty much, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and it if you remember back to when the Marlins were going through that sale from John Henry to Jeffrey Luria taking over the squad, and the fact that Dave was going to be let out and was going to be on the open market, there was a huge amount of interest with him at that point, too, coming off the Marlins World Series a few years earlier and the trades that he had made to rebuild that franchise after that. I think his stature is only bigger now, having done what he did with the Tigers and really changed the look of the franchise and done a reversal that kind of restored Detroit as a baseball city. You can say what you want about the payroll he was given compared with his predecessors, but that said, you know, he made some very good moves that helped bring this team not only to an expectation of winning year in and year out, but also where you've got superstars in Justin Verlander and Miguel Cabrera. I think that means a lot in the industry. And I think when you look around to owners who might be looking to win now and who would be willing to pay, here's a guy who's gone through that movement. And I think there's going to be a huge amount of appeal. And I think right now there's got to be at least a few general managers and assistants out there who have got to be a little nervous.
fact, one last thing in the immediate wake of the news. I'm not sure if this is an unprecedented arrangement, but it's certainly unusual that the general manager, his son, is on the ball club, and Alex Avila. Describe that dynamic for us. Obviously, it's nothing new in that they've both been at organization a long time, but I don't suspect we're about to get a press release about a 10-year contract extension for Alex Avila, or you know, see him in the cleanup spot in the batting order tomorrow or anything of that nature. But what do you think that dynamic is going to be like?
It's going to be interesting to watch, especially with Alex up for free agency at the end of the year. I think Al handled it about as well as he could. I think he expected that question to come up because he's ready with the line saying, you know how it is in Little League when, you know, the dad is the manager and the son is batting cleanup. That's not going to happen, was what he said. He also said it's been awkward in that he noted that he wasn't really in favor of the idea of drafting him, but that the scouting staff around him said that it made all the sense in the world when he dropped down to the fifth round, and given their need for a long-term solution at catcher at that point. But Al also noted that it's been a rewarding experience and it's been a blessing, but that it might be something that comes to an end. So it's going to be certainly something that bears watching here, and it's going to be an intriguing dynamic that follows in the free agency, and also somebody who we don't really know what the future holds for Alex, you know, just even from a playing standpoint, given the seasons he's had the last few years, and also the injury history. But that said, the on-base percentage and his ability to run a pitching staff are traits that I think are going to make him appealing to other clubs. So there's a whole drama set up here that it's going to be fun to follow, in addition to all the other stuff and the potential tug of war between Dave and Al for keeping competition.
All right, a lot of interesting storylines, a lot of interesting fallout coming out of this stunning news here. It's really stunned the baseball world. I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us to discuss all of that. I'm sure we'll delve into this more in future podcasts, Beck, and I'm sure you'll have plenty of material on Tigers.com, so folks can check that out. I am joined by Jordan Bastian, and we're going to recap the Tribe's deadline. It was an active deadline for the Indians, not in the way they would have wanted going into the season, but they were sellers. Trade away Brandon Moss, David Murphy, Mark Zepchinski snuck in there just before the final tick of the clock. They get back a couple pieces. Rob Kaminsky was the big one there, the A-ball pitcher they got from the Cardinals. Eric how do I pronounce this, JB? Stamets? What is it?
Stamets.
Stay Mets. If he heads over on the Mets, he can stay with the Mets. I don't know. And they saved around $6 million. That's no small thing either. Take me through this, JB. Obviously, we knew, you know, they were starting to trend towards the seller territory. And rather than do something really dramatic, these were more of pieces that didn't seem to be part of the 2016 picture, obviously.
Yeah, and I think in that regard, I think the Indians did pretty well. I think they probably just decided that they weren't going to be picking up Murphy's option. So you try and find anything you can get for him. And, you know, Stamets, well, he hasn't done much with the bat. He's got really good speed, and he's an above-average defender. And, you know, you can never have enough middle infield guys, especially at the upper rungs of the system. So, you know, we'll see what happens there in terms of whether that guy reaches the big leagues and helps out down the road. You know, and then in terms of Zepchinski, you know, this is a guy who was actually not doing the best in terms of facing left-handed pitching, and his job was to be a left-on-left guy, and he's a guy who's going to be arbitration eligible next year. So when the Indians actually had right-handers getting lefties out at a better rate, and Zepchinski was projected to maybe see his salary go over $3 million next year, maybe up to $4 million, you know, you start looking at, well, you know, maybe we can get something for him. They got a depth bat in Abraham Almonte, switch hitter, can play all three spots, just kind of one of those guys that you plug into the depth chart and hopefully he can help you out. And I think the trade that they really did well in was the Brandon Moss deal. This is a guy, again, is going to be arbitration eligible next year, and given the performance this season, maybe he's a non-tender candidate. So you look at a situation where see what you can get, and the Cardinals, who obviously had a big need once Matt Holliday went down with that injury, were willing to part with one of their pitching prospects, lefty Rob Kaminsky, and that right away becomes one of the top pitching prospects in the Indian system, a guy who has a really good curveball, a really, really high ground ball rate, and a guy who could project and maybe be a number three type starter down the road. So you turn Joe Wendell, infield prospect, into a top pitching prospect in terms of the two Brandon Moss trades involving the Indians, and you also shed some potential salary for next year. So all in all, again, as you pointed out, I don't think this is the position the Indians wanted to be in. I think they would have much rather have been in a position to be a buyer at the deadline. But, you know, as the players have all said, and as Francona has said, you know, they've played themselves into this position. So they made some deals, some subtraction deals, got some, minor league parts. And, you know, now they can kind of assess over the last 2 months and start looking towards next year.
Well, and that's the big question is next year, you know, how is this team going to be better? We know they're not going to go out and be make dramatic upgrades in free agency. And that led to all the Carlos Carrasco talk, obviously. Mostly led to Carlos Carrasco talk with teams calling about Carlos Carrasco. But it certainly led to a lot of discussion on the Indians end. And you just look at this roster and you think, well, you know, how are they going to move the needle? It might take moving one of these young, controllable pitching pieces to bring back some young, controllable bats. I don't know how you feel about all that, JB. Obviously, nothing happened with the Carrasco rumors, and we'll get to see him to continue to develop as a potentially elite arm in that rotation. But it is certainly something that I'm sure will generate discussion again this winter because, again, if you're not gonna make big splashes in free agency, you got to improve this club in other ways, and it might be having to rob from a strength to address a weakness.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think, you know, I didn't expect any of those starters to get dealt at this trade deadline, but you're exactly right. I think GM Chris Antonetti wouldn't be doing his job. If teams are calling, you don't hang up. You know, and you can value your own players to a certain extent. You got to know how other teams value them. And if other teams are willing to sell the farm or give you a big-time bat or something for a guy who's at a really team-friendly deal, you've got to listen, you've got to entertain it. I think that's why even on the trade deadline day, even after the night before, Carrasco had said, Francona already told me I'm not being traded. You know, so we had the pitcher saying, the manager already told me I'm not being traded, so I have nothing to worry about. And then the next morning, his name was still floating around in trade rumors, which was kind of entertaining and a little stressful. Given that we had just wrote how he said he wasn't going to be traded. But I think you go right up to the deadline, and if you're pushing those types of talks up to the deadline, even if you know you plan on holding on to the guy, you know, the other team on the other end of the phone might show their hand and show just how much they're willing to give for him. And maybe that lays some groundwork for the offseason or for future talks, whether it's for Carrasco or whether it's for one of their other young controllable arms, guys like Bauer and Salazar. And you're right. I mean, if they're not going to go out and spend or overspend to get that big thumper in the middle of the lineup, you know, I think you put it the best that you might have to kind of subtract from a strength to address a weakness.
Yeah, I don't know why any manager would ever promise a player he's not going to be traded, because if there's one rule in July, it's that things change very quickly. And all it takes is one phone call to get a team to change its stance. And so we'll see. I mean, the Astros – seemed like a really good trade partner until they made the Carlos Gomez deal, and they moved some of their young outfield pieces that seemed to match up pretty well. The Cubs might still be a good match going forward, whether it's Carrasco or Salazar or any of these guys, just as a team that has depth and position player pieces. That's what the Indians need right now. But as far as the rest of 2015 is concerned, we're getting
close
here.
Oh, yeah, there's 2 months left, right?
Go ahead, JB.
I said there's still 2 months left, right?
There's still 2 months, and we're going to get a good look at the return of Lonnie Chisenhall and Tyler Holt and Jerry Sand. Chisenhall is probably the most interesting of that group just because, you know, we know the history there with him and a former top prospect himself, but did not pan out at third base. That's now Giovanni Urshela's job, and Chisholm Hall is now kind of a roamer, which is interesting because a few years ago that was even a point of conversation. So they moved this guy to the corner outfield and just see what happens with his bat. Well, you know, now he is playing a little right field. He had a solid weekend in Oakland. I am joined, as always, by Scott Merkin. And Merk, it was an interesting deadline from the White Sox perspective. They were kind of prescribed as sellers for a long time. Then they got hot just before the end of July. And that obviously influenced Rick Hahn's decision to stand pat at the deadline, most particularly with Jeff Samardzija, who was, of course, a name bandied about quite a bit in the rumor mill. They won 7 in a row, but it was against the Indians and Red Sox, two last-place teams. Then they faced the first-place Yankees over the weekend and dropped 2 of 3. You know, given that context, Merk, what were your thoughts on the approach at the deadline in general?
Well, I mean, I think they stuck to their plan overall and that they weren't going to trade away their top prospects. You know, this is a plan to make them contenders every year and not just kind of go all – they had the all-in campaign a few years ago and it didn't work. So not just go all in 1 year and then kind of, you know, backpedal after that. So they weren't going to trade, you know, the Tim Andersons and Frank Montes of the world for a rental player. Remember, barring the Royals really coming back to the pack and everyone else, well, you know, the Twins, I guess, are just a little bit ahead of the Sox, but the Royals really coming back to the pack. The Sox are, you know, betting on a 50-50 proposition just to advance past one game. So I think it would be a little different if they thought they had a chance to catch the Royals. Let's say they were, instead of 3.5 out of the wild card, the second wild card, they were 3.5 behind the Royals. Then I think you would have seen a little different viewpoint. But, you know, for the wild card, even with the pitching they have and, you know, a potential series that lines up Sales, Samardzija, Quintana, they just weren't going to give up, you know, big prospects to get someone for a short period of time. And as for Samardzija, you know, they could have moved him still. They would still have shot him in free agency. But, you know, I think they felt like on the flip side, they still had a chance to make the playoffs if they kept the guys intact, especially their starting rotation. Now, the interesting thing is I thought the Yankees, you know, were a team in need of a little bit of starting pitching, and I thought Samardzija would be a good fit there, which could have been interesting because he could have been facing the Yankees on Sunday facing the White Sox at a pitching point.
Right.
But nothing ended up happening, and the Yankees took 2 of 3. Samardzija didn't have had a bad start on Sunday, and it's, you know, back to going after it again against Tampa. But I understood the philosophy on both ends, and I understood not wanting to overpay just for the possibility that you might get to host a wild card as opposed to, you know, being the road team in it.
Well, sticking with Samardzija, obviously, even if he leaves at the end of the season, they can recoup that draft pick. And I almost wonder, Murph, you know, some of these guys were probably rooting to be traded because then they're not tied to that qualifying offer that can affect their market. I'll be curious to see. I mean, not that he's going to linger like an Irvin Santana a couple years ago or anything like that where he's looking for a job in February or March by any means. But, you know, Samardzija could be impacted in some measure by being attached to draft pick compensation. That could just limit the number of teams willing to go the distance with him.
Yeah, I mean, you look at a guy like, you know, David Robertson and Melky Cabrera, they got pretty good money with a draft pick attached. I'm just looking at the Sox point of view for who they signed. But I think more than anything, you know, maybe well, that's part of it. You're definitely right. But I think also Samardzija probably would have liked to have gone to a team, especially before the 7-game winning streak, that he knew where he'd be pitching in kind of prime time, you know, where his starts would have meaning every single time out, not just if he had a really good start, it would get noticed. And I think, you know, with the Sox winning 7 in a row and the parity that is the second wild card, he will have that opportunity, assuming they don't, you know, do a complete turnaround after this. So, yeah, I think he certainly didn't want to leave, but I don't think it would have been a bad situation if he got traded to a contender for him either. I think he saw both sides. There's a lot of both sides in the trade deadline, and I think Samardzija saw both.
Well, for the White Sox to have another run like the 7 in a row and to remain a factor in the wild card, obviously a lot of that comes down to the offense. And there's been several guys who have had a nice midseason surge for them. Let's start with Alexi Ramirez. Merk, he had a conversation with Robin Ventura, I know, at the end of June, just about the way his season was going. He's really surged at the plate ever since. I'm not saying it's directly tied to that meeting, but there was definitely that just seemed to be a crossroads moment in his season. What's been the key for him and his bat taking shape here?
Well, I think he surged in the field, too, which is even more important for the White Sox. You know, they were a bad defensive team for a good part of the season. And, you know, nothing against Micah Johnson, who's actually injured right now, but
Carlos Sanchez was a little more advanced than Micah, and people knew that going into even spring training defensively. So putting Sanchez at second, Alexi coming back to norm at short, and then Saladino, Tyler Saladino, has been a great pickup, great promotion at third base. You know, really just a good ball player over there. I think we talked about it in the last podcast, but just kind of does everything right, does everything pretty well. Maybe not a Hall of Fame caliber player or perennial All-Star, but a really good ball player. And I think Alexi is just, you know, he's just kind of an up-and-down player. You know, Robin has said this a couple times, that eventually you're going to see his numbers get back to where they normally are, and they're heading in that direction now. You know, he may not be a 20-home run guy again, as he, you know, or close to that as he has been in the past, but he also is stealing more bases. So I think the key for Alexi is, yeah, it's good that he's hitting again and giving them some production from the middle to the lower third of the order, but it's even better that he's playing the defense that made him a Gold Glove finalist last year. That was a big glaring absence from him at the beginning of the season, and that was, you know, part of the reason why the team was not very good. They have pitchers who, a lot of left-handers, first of all, and they have pitchers who, you know, are not all strikeout pitchers like Sales. So you're relying on your defense, and when you're giving them four or five, six outs sometimes in an inning, you're not going to be, you know, a contender, that's for sure. And Jeff Samardzija mentioned, I should mention one more thing about Samardzija, that he's really kind of well-versed on the whole baseball picture, so he knows what's going on. He's not just out there saying, well, you know, give me the best offer and I'll jump at it. He knows the situation. He knows what he wants. And he pointed out the other day that he thought the defense was kind of undervalued in the whole turnaround. Yeah, the offense had been killing the ball on the road trip, but I think the defense overall has made a huge difference for the White Sox and its improvement.